Chevy Buick and McMahon's Import Corner. At the new McMahon, we make deals the other guys won't. Chevy, find new roads. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is made possible in part each Wednesday by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do, a better business relationship. By Business Energy Action, challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. By Fairpoint Communications, small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. By Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. And by the over 1,000 VBSR members. Here's noted Vermont author David Goodman.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. Today we have a diverse show. In the second half hour, we'll be looking at the global work of the Vermont-based nonprofit, the Institute for Sustainable Communities. In our first half hour, we'll be talking with one of my favorite writers and one of Vermont's most acclaimed national journalists, David Dobbs of Montpelier. Dave Dobbs writes books as well as features and essays for the New York Times, National Geographic, The Atlantic, Slate, and other publications. He's now working on his fourth book called The Orchid and the Dandelion. Dave's magazine features are regularly chosen for leading anthologies. The most recent to be selected is The Social Life of Genes, a story he wrote last year for Pacific Standard about how genes and social life shape one another. His memoir of his mother's secret wartime affair, My Mother's Lover, was a number one best-selling Kindle single. Dave Dobbs, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thanks for having me.
So, as a writer living in Montpelier, you're covering national issues and issues about science in particular. How did you become focused on science as your main topic?
Well, it actually started in the North Woods here up in the northern part of the state. I did a book with a friend about, it's called The Northern Forest, and it was about the fragmentation of the woods across northern New England and upstate New York by overcutting and real estate development. And we did a little bit of science in that, forestry. And then after that, I did another, what I thought was going to be an environmental book about the collapse of the cod fishery in New England. And what I saw there was that the fishermen and the fishery scientists were having this huge argument over how many fish were there. And it was a scientific argument, but it was also driven heavily by cultural differences. So that's how I got into science. And from there, I wrote another book, a historical book about science, a long fight that Charles Darwin had with about how coral reefs formed. The fight actually started before Darwin was born and lasted long after he died, but he was at the center of it. And that was another one that cultural issues and deep biases and differences of how one viewed the world that were non-scientific colored a scientific debate. And I've been writing about that ever since.
Were you a science major in college?
I was not. I was an English major.
So do you find yourself bumping up against the limitations of your own knowledge of science?
My own fast ignorance. Yes, I do. I do. But so does every scientist. I mean, that's what it's about. It's about going to the edge of your knowledge and trying to be rigorous about interpreting what is beyond those margins. Scientists do that. I have to do the same thing. I have to, read up a lot on whatever science I'm writing about, talk to a lot of people, run my conclusions by people, which is something scientists also do, of course. It's to test your hypothesis about something. So that that can take some extra time and has added to the time it's taken me to write my current book, which is about genetics. In particular, genetic ideas about how we behave, which if you want a project to take a lot longer than you expect, that's a great one to pick because it's unbelievably complicated, and the whole world of genetics is under massive transition right now.
Why does this interest you, the genetics?
Well, It's partly because it is at the edge of science's capacity to explain things. So by definition, it's people, you know, stepping off of kind of the safer ground, which science in general does. But this is, behavior is an enormously complicated thing. And it's enormously consequential that we understand it as, you know, individuals. The better you understand other people's behavior, the better you are able to manage your place in the world. And in science's case, it's a really ambitious project to try to understand behavior.
We're talking with Vermont journalist Dave Dobbs. You can join this conversation at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. And you can listen to this entire conversation after we go offline at vermontconversation.com, where all shows of the Vermont Conversation are archived. So, Dave, let's dive in to this very issue, the issue of genetics, society, politics. This past Sunday, you had a review in the New York Times Book Review. And when I read the New York Times Book Review, I have to confess, I often skip through the nice reviews to look for the nasty ones, because that's where the good stuff is. And so I would have been really happy. I was very happy to come across your review. You are actually reviewing a New York Times science writer, Nicholas Wade's, new book called A Troublesome Inheritance, Genes, Race, and Human History. And you write that Wade's book is, quote, deeply flawed, deceptive, and dangerous. You have my attention. Why is this book dangerous?
Well, Wade is making an argument that he knows is explosive. He is resurrecting a long line of scientific attempts to make scientific explanations for differences in the capacity of different human races, usually, amazingly, coming out in a way that makes Caucasians or white people look like the most superior race. Now, this goes way back to at least the middle of the 19th century. It led 100 years ago to the eugenics movement, which led and fed in very direct fashion the Nazi attempt to exterminate an entire population, to try to kill every Jew on earth, and they killed 6 million. 1 million of them were children. They also killed people who seemed mentally disabled, and they killed anyone. They killed a lot of people because they were gay. So this is a very dangerous argument. Wade, to his credit, acknowledges that, and his chapter actually on this horrible history of eugenics is in many ways quite good. So he knows this is a dangerous argument. So why make it?
And let's just define eugenics is the belief and practice of improving the genetic quality of the human population.
Yes, so you can see how much trouble that can get you into. If you've decided that the human population consists of different races who are quite distinct from one another in some inherent sense, and you've taken upon your authority to try to improve the human race, then you can try to either encourage the acceleration of the procreation of the people with the good genes, the best race, and you can also go down the slippery slope to discouraging the reproduction of those who aren't fit, or even the outright extermination of them. So this is how these ideas about race have led to some of the worst catastrophes in human history. Now, Wade knows all this, and he knows that he needs a reason to offer this argument. His rationale, his claim, is that the advances in genetics over the last decade or so now make it clear that not only are there distinct races in humanity, he names five races and says three of them are major races: Caucasians, Sub-Saharan Africans, and East Asians. So not only do these races exist as distinct entities, but they have, since the time that humanity walked out of Africa, started migrating out of Africa 50,000 years ago, the different populations went to different places and faced different challenges, and that these challenges shaped these different populations in various ways. They made them behave differently. They were naturally selected to deal with certain challenges, and that sort of set up a snowball in which traits then made them good at something, and they would develop distinctly. So what he ends up with is that of these three major races, one had the great good luck to be shaped in a way that made them fitter for the modern world than the other two. And I think we can all guess which that race is. It's Caucasians, represented most emphatically in his eyes by the English and white Western Europe and now North America. And his argument is that Caucasians are better fit because they have different levels of trust that they've developed over the years and created a society that rewarded certain genes that then created those traits. Now, it becomes a circular argument, you can perceive at that point. And this would be a dicey, testy argument on several levels. It's irresponsible, in my view, because it's an extraordinary claim. And in science, as they like to say, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And as many population geneticists and other scientists who have reviewed this book have concluded, he simply does not have anywhere near the evidence required to demonstrate this argument.
Why would a science writer for the New York Times, so this is a guy very much at the top of the game and in a very high visibility position, skate out onto this extraordinarily thin ice and fraught territory in which he's essentially advocating a form of scientific racism?
You know, I don't know, and I would hate to speculate about Wade's motives here. I mean, I think he has a long interest in human evolution. Human evolution is a fascinating subject, and the evidence that we have continued to evolve is rich and in many ways encouraging. It shows that we still have a flexibility. So I don't think his interest started from a bad place, and I don't really want to speculate about his motives. I don't want to pass judgment over whether he's a racist. But this book is friendly to racism. It has been welcomed by some racists. And again, if he has really good scientific evidence to bolster this argument, maybe we do need to have this conversation, as he claims. Mm-hmm. He says the science is to the place where we should have this conversation. It's time we face up and quit being squeamish about talking about race. That's fine to say if that's the case, but yeah, the evidence is just not there.
The other thing that surprised me was that the New York Times Book Review allowed you to savage one of their own guys on their pages. Was there any pushback about the kind of strong language that you used to debunk this book?
No, there wasn't. Some of it is, you know, that the New York Times is a big building. It's a big paper. It's a big staff. The different departments. I don't have deep insight into the inner workings of the Times, but I do know that the different departments have quite a lot of autonomy, and that the Book Review clearly feels it can assign a review about a book written by one of its writers, and will be open to the reviewers take on the book. So I just credit to that to good editorial policy there, where they feel safely protected by their higher ups from this sort of thing. And I hope it didn't seem that I savaged Nicholas Wade, the person. I was harsh about his book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're talking with Vermont journalist David Dobbs here on The Vermont Conversation. You can join this by calling us at 244-1777 or toll-free in central Vermont, 877-291-8255. One of the many interesting articles that you've written, and listeners who are interested who want to read more can go to daviddobbs.net for a fuller collection, and also a very robust daily blog that you maintain on interesting articles in science and society that I often consult, as well as a very lively Twitter feed that you run, among other things. So one of the articles that you wrote was called, for the New York Times Magazine, was called A Depression Switch. And you described this as a rare win in the neuroscience world. Tell me what the depression switch is.
Right. First, before I get into it, too much trouble, I did use those words, a rare win. That may be overstating it, but because the neuroscience has made great advances, but it still is a discipline early in its going. It's still fairly, it's very robust, it's healthy, it's finding a lot of great things, but it's still early. And, you know, if you enter a room and everything you find is new, which is what neuroscience is doing, it's a sign that you really don't know that room thoroughly. But this was an investigation by a neurologist named Helen Mayberg, works down at Emory in Atlanta, and she was curious about this one area of the brain called Area 25, which is this little, it's about the size of an almond down in the center of your brain.
Isn't that a movie that Sylvester Stallone starred?
Area 25.
Oh, sorry.
Could be. that's something altogether different, which may be depressing also. But there was this one area in the brain that she saw in a long series of scan studies and hard theoretical work was actually hyperactive in people who were depressed or in people who made themselves very sad by thinking sad thoughts. And she wondered, pulling on work from Parkinson's, where there's a part of the brain in Parkinson's that's also hyperactive, that if they took it out, it would alleviate the movement disorders in Parkinson's. So she wondered if they could quiet this with a better technology, not remove it, but quiet it down by buzzing it with a little implant that released a subtle current. Maybe that would help the depression. And it did. It has done so in several trials she's done, totaling about 50 patients. I would have to check the latest, but about 50 patients, and half to two-thirds, these are people who are unbelievably depressed, and they've tried everything and nothing has worked. They are non-functional, and then they return to, about half are actually technically cured. Their depression scores drop that much, and many others respond. So this sort of offered a very new explanation for what created depression. The previous one was based on neurochemicals. It has lost credence over the last decade, and this is more a wiring diagram explanation, as Mayberg calls it, that suggests that if you can find the right circuits and find an easier way to tweak them than inserting this node, this stimulator, perhaps you could help a lot of people whose depression doesn't yield to other treatments.
Wow. That is fascinating. We have a caller on the line, Carl from Bethel. Welcome to the Vermont Conversation, Carl.
Hi. Thanks a lot. I apologize for taking you back a step, but I was really intrigued by the comments about the review of the genetics book. And I'll probably have to find it to read it, but it jumped right out to me as a question. Since you've read it, maybe you would be able to answer this. Was there any evaluation in his argument about whether or not the Caucasians had, in fact, influenced the development of the modern world to suit their own genetic makeup as opposed to the other way around? How he was defining the modern world. The other thing that bothers me is that I'm not sure that the modern world is really all that conducive to long-term human existence anyway.
Right. Well, that's a legitimate point to raise, certainly. From a one measure of species success, we're really doing great. We've spread across around the entire globe, and we can live almost anywhere. And Wade does recognize that we are shaping the world we live in. I mean, it's heavily shaped. Culture is our way of shaping the world. When you start with the first tool, you have altered the world so that you can manipulate it better to meet your needs. He recognizes all this and writes a bit about how he sees this kind of snowball going on where we created a certain culture that was about trade and that sort of thing. And that culture was possible because of certain steps we took. For instance, about 1,000 years ago in England, there was established the rule of law, law as the ultimate ruler, as he puts it, in which the law itself, a set of rules, trumped any person's power to change things.
That was the Magna Carta.
The Magna Carta and other things associated with it, so that allowed a wider circle of trust because you had rules that everyone agreed you could play by, and because of that, trade was safer to conduct with people who lived far away because you had rules to settle things by. So this created a sort of rules-based culture in which trade and all the great things that come out of trade can be conducted safely. And it allowed, if the rules are good, you can trust people more. Because if an individual wrongs you, you can depend on the rules to make it right. This happened. That encouraged and rewarded the reproduction of people with genes that that helped us be trusting. This says, Wade argues this, and that in turn created a more trusting society and so on. So that's his argument. The problem is there's no way to prove it because he can't point to any genes that actually do this. So it's a very speculative argument.
Okay, well, we have another caller on the line, Eudora, I think it is, from Montpelier.
Yes.
Welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Dobbs, were you talking about ECGs when you referred to you were talking about ECGs, weren't you?
No, the brain stimulation you're probably referring to, it's not... electroshock therapy. This is a thing called a deep brain stimulator, and instead of shocking the whole brain, they slide this little lead. It's a thing on the end of a tiny wire. They drill a hole in your skull and snake this thing down into a certain place, and it just releases a tiny bit of electricity that is active and affects an area about the size of a pea. So it's a much different thing than high voltage.
ECGs, I recommend them highly, honey, but I forgot so much. A lot I can't remember. Like Joel says, you remember so many things, but that isn't my fault. I just do.
No, that is one problem with ECT, that ECT has been able to, electroshock therapy has been able to help some cases of depression that don't respond to other things. But a lot of memory loss is a not infrequent side effect.
Let me just jump in here in the couple minutes we have left, because I just have a hunch, Dave Dobbs, that a great bit of summer reading that listeners might enjoy is your... number one best-selling Kindle single about your mother's secret wartime affair. Tell me a little bit about My Mother's Lover.
Yeah, this was a real treat for me, a different kind of book. It wasn't about science. It was a memoir about my mother, who in World War II had an affair with a flight surgeon named Angus.
And how did you find out about that?
Well, she told us that sentence I just said. She had told us in the 1970s when we were kids. That's all we knew, that she had been in love with a flight surgeon named Angus in the Second World War, and he died when the Japanese shot his plane down. That was it. Then on her deathbed, she tells us that she'd like to be cremated and her ashes spread in Hawaii so she can be with Angus, which there were five of us, my siblings and I, in the room when she said this, and we're all looking at each other asking, what? No one knew, saw this coming. We thought Angus was kind of a blip. Or somebody she sort of longingly thought of. But it turned out there was an amazing story here about how she met him and the reverb from this event when his plane was shot down and she lost this man when her life was just beginning. And the reverberations were felt, I don't want to give too much away, but through two families, through... 6 decades and counting. It was an absolutely amazing story that you find out a lot about your mom that you would never have dreamed. My Mother's Lover. It's available at a place called The Atavist, ATAVIST, or through Amazon.
Okay. Well, on that note, Dave Dobbs, I want to thank you for joining us, and listeners can go to daviddobbs.net to read more of Dave Dobbs's really remarkable writings. Thanks so much for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation, Dave.
It's a real pleasure, as always, David.
Okay. And we'll be back after the news.
29 minutes or less, guaranteed. That's all it takes to get your oil changed at Cody Chevrolet Cadillac. We will change your oil and filter and top off your fluids in 29 minutes or less, or your next one is free. All for only $22.95 from most vehicles. No appointment is needed, so stop by today and have Cody Chevrolet's certified service experts change your oil in 29 minutes or less. Guaranteed. Chevy certified service at Cody Chevrolet Cadillac. Another reason, Cody is why, Chevy's the buy.
You are listening to the stations of Radio Vermont, WDEV, FM, and AM. Reminder, coming up, the Times Argus Midseason Championship. You'll hear it tomorrow night at 8, right here on DEV, FM, and AM. Time now to check some news.
AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire. An experimental drug made by Genentech could not slow mental decline in more than 500 people with mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. But it did show some promise in the least impaired participants who received a higher dose. AP medical writer Marilyn Marchione says the drug was able to slow the progress of the disease in the least impaired patients.
People with the mildest stages of Alzheimer's that were given the higher dose of the drug, they declined about 35% less on cognitive measures than the others who were given a dummy drug.
Marchione reports that Genentech says it will continue its tests on people who have the greatest risk of developing Alzheimer's.
This drug is still being tested in a prevention trial to see whether it can ward off dementia in people at a high risk of it.
About 35 million people around the world have Alzheimer's, the most common form of dementia. There is no cure, and current treatments only temporarily ease the symptoms. AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire.
The Still Theater Guild presents Leonard Bernstein's classic musical, On the Town. Celebrating its 70th anniversary, the show features such classics as New York, New York, Some Other Time, and You've Got Me. All shows are presented on Wednesday through Saturday evenings, July 16th through 19th, July 23rd through 26th, and July 30th through August 2nd at 8 p.m. at the Town Hall Theater in the Akeley Memorial Building in Stowe. Tickets are available by calling 802-253-3169 or on the web at stowtheater.com.
This Sunday afternoon, the ACT International 300 will take place at Airborne Speedway in Plattsburgh, New York. The $100,000 event will pay over $25,000 to the winner. Teams from Quebec, New York, and all six New England states will battle for the glory of the win and the $25,000. Joey Pohl, Brian Hoare, Alex Labbe, Jonathan Boubrant, Patrick LaPerle, and Gene Sear are all ready to do battle at Airborne on Sunday, July 20th. Saturday night is the return of the Traveling Thrill Show at Airborne with the Black Cat Hell Drivers. It's a family thrill show for just $10 admission per adult, or a family of two adults and two kids for just $20. Then Sunday, July 20th, the International returns ACT Late Models, Airborne's own Sportsman Modifieds, Quebec Pro Cam Trucks, and Thunder Roads Tigers. Post time is 1 o'clock. Gates open at 9 a.m. Just $25 for general admission. Check the ACT website for all the information. Don't miss it this Sunday, Airborne ACT International 300.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility makes the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman available each Wednesday, along with People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do, a better business relationship. National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow. Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. And Business Energy Action. Challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. As well as over 1,000 plus VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. In our second half hour, we are going global, and that is to look at the work of the Vermont-based nonprofit Institute for Sustainable Communities. The Institute for Sustainable Communities was founded in 1991 by former Governor Madeline Cunin and George Hamilton. They have now done 98 projects in 30 countries. They have 85 staff currently working in Serbia, China, Bangladesh, India, and the U.S. To talk about what ISC does, we'll turn first to ISC founder and director George Hamilton. George, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thanks, David. It's good to be here.
So first of all, this week, this is a big week for you. You have a number of your international staff who are meeting right in Stowe. Tell me what's going on for you this week.
Well, we're bringing together about 55 of our staff from our different offices and talking about our developing new strategy for the organization, which is really focusing on now on accelerating climate and sustainability solutions. And one of the reasons we were founded was because we believe that healthy communities are the foundation of a peaceful and healthy planet. And the biggest threat now to many of the communities around the world is climate change. And so we're focusing on how we can think more creatively about interventions that achieve significant reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, help vulnerable communities adapt and become more resilient, while at the same time dealing with resource efficiency issues, environmental health, and also economic prosperity in some of the poorest countries in the world.
How did, going back to 1991, so at that point, Madeleine Cunin had just retired as governor.
That's correct.
What motive, and I suppose this could have been a question for her, she's been a guest on here several times, but how did her running Vermont transform into this global focus with you?
Well, she and I actually were invited to participate on a delegation to Bulgaria to observe the first democratic elections. And at the time, you know, that was a period when the Soviet Union was collapsing, and there was a lot of attention around the environmental health problems of Eastern Europe. And the passion that people had for decentralized decision-making, which they hadn't had much experience with, and also just to basically take responsibility for some of these serious problems and to build sustainable economies, you know, and to deal with human needs that all of us want met. And so we decided to form an institute that would share some best practices with these communities that were struggling to engage their citizens and to take action on these serious problems. And from there, it just took off because I think people really responded to our sincere interest in helping them be more successful in building their own institutional capacity and their own individual leadership skills to solve their own problems. And also our strong commitment to community, which, by the way, is a very popular idea around the world.
So tell me a little bit about where you're working these days and what kind of projects to really illustrate, you know, how you're going about creating sustainable communities.
Sure. One of the reasons we focused a lot on Eastern Europe in the early days, and now we've shifted our focus a bit more to Asia and also the United States, because these are the biggest emitting countries of greenhouse gas emissions, and we see, therefore, an opportunity to turn these countries around and to make them more responsible leaders on the topic. And the way we do that is by focusing on local and regional solutions. We're very much about bringing people together to achieve really significant changes around greenhouse gas reductions and really targeting the biggest emitters around in the countries. Like, for example, in China and Asia, a significant portion of the manufacturing, which produces a lot of goods around the world, also generates a significant amount of the greenhouse gas emissions, causing serious environmental health problems in China particularly, but also in the other countries, and also consuming a huge amount of energy. So we designed a program which is to train factory managers that are working in the supply chain of major companies, give them the skills to provide a comprehensive look at factories, look at all aspects of the inputs, resources that factories use, how they can be used more efficiently, how they can actually reduce or reuse a lot of their waste products, and to create a healthier work environment for the workers and a significant reduction in greenhouse gas emissions and emissions to the surrounding communities.
I have this image in China, though, of, you know, kind of Rust Belt era factories just belching massive amounts of pollution into the air to the point that it's killing their own people. How does an institute come in and say, you know, we can do this more cleanly?
Right. And part of it is creating the incentives for them to want to do the right thing, right? So we actually work with big companies, big buyers, like Apple and GE and Walmart, and these companies with the big supply chain, and they're, you know, rightly concerned about their reputations, their brands, because they want to make sure that these supply chains are operating in an efficient way, in an environmentally friendly way, in a way that helps worker, improves worker health and safety. So, but the problem was that many of these factories on their supply chain didn't have champions, internal champions, who really understood how that factories are like systems, that you can, if you take a management system approach to managing resources within a factory, and you can make the business case to the owner to make the investments that you need to reduce energy or water use and improve worker health and safety conditions, it's going to have a big impact. And so we set up these two centers now in China that are each training 2,000 factory managers per year, and a whole host of skill development areas that help them see these factories as systems, and that they can then make sort of more transform. They can be champions for transformation within these factories. And these companies now, we got about 150 companies now saying, you know, we want you to. You're telling their supply chain to send their factory managers to these training centers to be trained. And so now, collectively, over the years, we've trained over 15,000 factory managers. And now these factory managers are now equipped to champion change within the supply chain in China. And now, by popular demand, we're moving the same concept to Bangladesh, where, as you know, there's been some serious problems in the factories there around fire safety, around building standards. And so we're also opening a center there to provide comprehensive training. We're also looking at India as well and other areas of Asia where we can start creating some momentum. And then now we're creating this network of these centers so that these champions can continuously improve their skills and communicate with one another and begin driving the whole regional supply chain towards sustainable manufacturing, which is our ultimate goal.
Can you give an example of where you've had an impact in China? Because it does still seem as if we still hear, even with these big brands like Apple, we're hearing about the scandal at Foxconn, one of their big suppliers, you know, where sweatshop conditions. And so give me an example of how you've had an impact in China.
Yeah, well, we estimate that, you know, we've trained a lot of factory managers, and they've, in areas like such as energy efficiency, and we estimate that the training that we've delivered and the implementation measures that have been adopted as a result of that training have achieved greenhouse gas reductions equivalent to removing all the cars off the island of Manhattan for 5 years, for example. So part of that is your point earlier about the quality of these factories and the amount of low-hanging fruit that exists there to make significant gains in energy efficiency. But also, we've introduced new concepts like giving worker voice, increasing participation of workers in decisions. We've created achieved significant reductions in water use and reuse, encouraging more reuse, and a whole host of things. And, you know, the things that are happening, you know, your example you gave about Foxconn, you know, Apple, you know, as a result of that incident at Foxconn, has, you know, did a scan of all of the available training for its supply chain and concluded after that fairly thorough search that our model was the most, delivering the highest quality training. And it took a comprehensive approach, which is what they wanted. And it was, and they really bought into the whole thing. So now they're asking us to train their entire supply chain and offering in all 20 course areas. So this is, you know, this is a situation where a company, you know, had very bad practices in the past and have wanted now to become a leader on the topic and not just fix the problem, but actually lead in the area of sustainable manufacturing and really making their supply chain a model for the others.
Hmm. I know that you've got one of the Institute for Sustainable Communities staff members there. We're talking about with George Hamilton, the head of the Institute for Sustainable Communities, about the work that ISC does. So one of your foreign staff is with you, and perhaps you can put him on, and we can hear a little bit about the work on the is happening on the ground.
Sure. Adil?
I'm here.
Hi, Adil. Tell us a little bit about what you do.
Thanks, David, for having us on the show. I'm the country director for the Institute for Sustainable Communities. I joined ISC after living and working in the U.S. Working on environmental issues and broader sustainability issues on a broad level. So I've in Bangladesh I've been taking on the helm to try and drive the some of these solutions that we've seen that we've been able to produce in China, but in the context of what makes sense in Bangladesh. We really don't believe in a copy paste solution. So whatever things we provide, it has to be something that makes sense to the community, in Bangladesh, and also the specific, industrial community of the ready-made garments industries and others in Bangladesh.
Now, let's just to put this in context. Many people recall that last year, Bangladesh was the scene of one of the worst industrial accidents in the world when a building, Rana Plaza, which is home to many sewing, companies that do private label sewing for big name manufacturers here in the States, are housed. 1,100 people, more than 1,100 people, died in that disaster. The picture we got at that time was, an industry that, is located in neighborhoods, very poor, economically poor. How do you go in and make a difference there?
That's a very good question. It really is quite challenging. So to first put a little perspective, a lot of times people who work in these factories are not, and the transportation system in Dhaka, where Rana Plaza was located, in outskirts of Dhaka, the transportation is a big issue. So people do live in the workers, the line workers, they live in little shanties or other places that they can afford very close to where they work. So they actually, they have to be able to walk to these places. So it's not, unusual to see things like that. And traditionally, the industry, the ready-made garments, typically known as RMG industry, has been in the central part of Dhaka. Now it has been moved, they're slowly trying to move these out of the centralized, out of these, little spots within Dhaka mixed in with residential to an industrial zone where they're hoping to be able to manage a lot of the infrastructure support that is needed. One of the things that is coming around in the near future that's primarily coming as a pressure from the brands is that they do not want to have multi-use buildings for these factories, and one of the reasons is because the traditional an RMG factory would be a mixed use building, and what that means is that they would be, maybe it was originally meant to be an apartment, and which has a certain load limit. And now it's been transformed into a factory floor where, of course, the dead load, as to say, is a lot higher than what you would normally see in a regular apartment. So these changes, are extremely important to move the industry towards having more safer, structural, workplaces. We anticipate, there's a lot of, as you can imagine, asking any factory manager to just pick up and move and find another, brand new factory is not something that you can just ask. That has to take some time, and there has to be some collaborative solutions that that the industries working with the brands and the factories have to come together.
Are you confident with the work that you're doing that we won't see another building collapse, or as has happened prior to this, catastrophic factory fires at these, seems fair to call them sweatshops that abound in Bangladesh?
Yeah, that's a harsh reality of life. It's something that we have to deal with. We train ourselves to do is to find the best solutions to reduce the risk of something happening. When you get into a vehicle, you want to make sure all the parts are working, your systems are working, you're wearing your seatbelt, you follow the rules and everything. But ultimately, can we say that we'll never get into a collision? So when it comes down to this specific issue of factory fires, they're still happening. Building collapse so far, none since Rana Plaza, which was extremely tragic. But one thing that, the industry is moving towards is to find solutions to make sure that people's lives are given more value, that, there are systems in place, that we can actually put systems in place to make sure that even if when something goes wrong, that we have systems in place to make sure that people are saved. And that's something that we also accept. But we, as George has alluded to, we really focus on management systems. One thing that you can imagine, since Tazreen fire, which was the year before Rana Plaza, where about 110, about a tenth of the people that died in Rana Plaza. But that was significant. It was very significant for people to understand that, product safety should not be the reason why you compromise on employee safety. You remember that there were, you may recall that the people, the gates were locked. When the fire broke out, people were unable to get out, and that was the cause for a big cause for why so many people died. And the funny thing is, not really funny, but the thing that people don't recognize is even some of those factories had undergone a lot of audits that showed that they had other systems in place to make sure fire doesn't break out or fire is managed. But then there are other systems were not in place to make sure that people were taken care of. So these are extremely important things that we would like to make sure the right kind of management systems are in place to make sure that the emphasis is placed on health and safety of workers.
David, let me just jump in because I think
this is George Hamilton, the director of the Institute for Sustainable Communities. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of code of conduct, there's a lot of audits, there's a lot of even policies that are decent in these countries, but the problem is that there's not a culture of compliance. There's not a commitment to full implementation of these policies. So one of our strategies really is to give skills to people within the factories that understand the importance of these policies and approaches and can actually implement them and come up with efficient ways to create management systems internally to achieve multiple benefits to the factories, to the workers, to the surrounding communities. And this is a brand new concept in Bangladesh. I mean, there's not this training, this kind of training isn't offered currently. And so we're filling an important niche, and we hope to stimulate others to get into the space because we want to make it easier for these factories to do the right thing.
Well, George Hamilton, so you are now, I guess we're coming close to the quarter century mark in the life of the organization you founded, the Institute for Sustainable Communities. Is there a vignette, something you've seen in your travels that gives you, I don't know, that you're proudest of when you reflect on it, that sort of says to you, yeah, this is what I got into this to do?
Yeah, and it comes down to hope. one of the things that I struggle with when you deal with these issues globally is how difficult it is when people don't cooperate and there's all this division and conflict and all these incredible global challenges. And the thing that I come back to is the people we meet in the different countries who are struggling every day to improve their lives and the lives of their fellow community members. And the optimism that they have working under extremely difficult decisions that they can build a better life for themselves. And that, to me, is very inspiring. And it's been an incredibly important part of this work and gives, frankly, me some optimism that we will work out these problems and we'll have a better planet to live on.
Are there takeaway lessons that you think are particularly applicable and relevant to here in the U.S. from some of your overseas work?
Yes. In fact, we are working. We have a very robust U.S. program, which we're working on to help connect and accelerate climate sustainability solutions among about 500 cities in the U.S. We haven't had a chance to talk about that, but this is a program designed to connect key leaders in different areas within a city with their counterparts in other cities so they can efficiently learn and apply best practices. And again, I think from my standpoint, the lesson learned is the value of connecting people, or champions, we call them, people within cities, within factories, equipping them with the right tools and the right leadership skills to constantly push for positive change. And then connect them to a network so they continuously learn from each other and support each other so that when, you know, we get the big incentives like the comprehensive climate policy adopted or some urgent crisis motivates more systemic change, then we'll have the people in place, the networks in place, to move toward a more positive future for all of our communities.
This is happening, your climate change work, of course, is happening against a backdrop here in the U.S. where you have a number of powerful political leaders and corporate leaders who deny that there is even a problem with climate change. How do you move forward against that backdrop?
To get action at the local level. I mean, one of the things we're doing, for example, in South Florida, this is the four counties of South Florida are the most vulnerable, really, in the world to sea level rise. And we've worked with them to develop a compact to work with one another and getting all the businesses involved and the government agencies, Republicans and Democrats, to adopt an aggressive climate action plan that calls for greenhouse gas reductions, but also calls for a number of infrastructure decisions that will protect their communities from sea level rise. And these kinds of solutions at the local level, we feel, we'll start bringing people together, because at the local level, that's where the rubber meets the road. You know, that's where people really can't avoid or play politics very easily. So if you can create solutions at the local level, those will be building blocks for solutions at the state level, and then we'll just eventually get the folks in Washington to get out of our way.
Okay. Well, on that note, I want to thank you, George Hamilton and Adil Chowdhury of the Institute for Sustainable Communities, for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
Thanks, David.
George Hamilton is the director of the Institute for Sustainable Communities. Adil Chowdhury is the Bangladesh country director for the Institute for Sustainable for Sustainable Communities. I want to let listeners know that VBSR next week will be holding a July networking get-together hosted by Green Mountain College in Pulteney. That's from 5:30 to 7:30. You can learn more about that by going to vbsr.org, the website. Everyone is welcome to join. VBSR members are welcome to join for this networking get-together. And for the Vermont Conversation, go to vermontconversation.com, and you'll find this show by this afternoon and all other shows archived, and you can listen to any one of them, a year and a half's worth, and find out a little bit more or send a contact and comment on any shows. Thanks very much for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation. We'll be back next week, Wednesday at 1 here on WDEV.
You have been listening to the Vermont Conversation with host David Goodman. Tune in next Wednesday when once again, Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and its over 1,000 EBSR members, along with Fairpoint Communications, small business owners make it big with Fairpoint, National Life Insurance for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow, People's United Bank, find out what know-how can do, and Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to patient, community, and medicine since 1879, as well as Business Energy Action, challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. These all help to bring you David Goodman with this special program.
You are listening to the stations of Radio Vermont, WD.